This is an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. We're here at day one of the Visionary Annual Conference 2025, and the Excellence in Inclusion panel has just taken place. I'm joined by the panellists to talk over some of the highlights. So, can you introduce yourselves?
So, I am Robbie Crowe.
Hi there, I'm Ellie Southwood.
I'm Darren Harris.
Thank you so much for a really interesting panel. You started as moderator, Ellie. Libby Clegg was also here as well. So we started with talking about allyship. And Robbie, you had a really great point about what that word means to you. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, I think allyship is just, you know, it might be a non-disabled person, it might be another disabled person being there, just to be that sort of good voice on your shoulder to go, you know, I'm with you, you're doing the right thing. I think that's often what's needed, just that bit of extra, you know, power to your elbow to make you not feel alone. I think very often as blind people, you know, we can be taught that being independent means doing things on your own. You need to do things solo, you need to be able to succeed on your own. But actually for me, independence is about choosing when you have that support and how you get that support. It's not necessarily about doing things on your own.
Mm. And Darren, you were saying that allyship as a word is not one that you think always captures all of the different opinions in the blind and partially sighted community. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I just think, you know, like any community, there's diverse opinions across the blind community, even around language, what we call ourselves. And I think sometimes when we talk about allies, it feels like sometimes you're either kind of with one group or against the group. So I think sometimes it can be divisive as well. And we live in this sort of social media polarized world anyway as it is, and so even a word as simple as that can have its own connotations to different people.
Another point that all of you touched on was the importance of maintaining traditional skills, both in terms of kind of tech and also mobility, while also trying to find ways to embrace AI and improving technology for navigation. So I'll come to you first, Ellie. What are your thoughts about the traditional skills that are still really important?
I am a huge fan of tech. I'll be, you know, the first to be experimenting with new stuff. AI is great. To get the best out of it, though, there's a set of skills that I think we all need, like asking great questions, which is the same if you're asking ChatGPT something as it is if you stop someone in the street, asking them to look for something for you, to be your eyes for a moment. You know, that is the same skill set. So I think it's keeping up those sort of foundational, I'd say, skills, so that in any scenario, you're never going to be left, even if your phone battery dies, you're never going to be left in a situation that is dangerous, scary, or that you would avoid and therefore choose not to leave your house.
And Darren, you talked about for you kind of bridging tools that helped you move into using new technology. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I was thinking actually that, you know, Robbie mentioned about people not being taught JAWS, but they're also not teaching people Braille anymore either, are we? So I do think those sort of fundamental skills are really important. And going to Ellie's point about the communication, I was talking to an employer the other day who says, you know, we're getting kids coming out of university with 11 GCSEs and 5 area levels and 2 degrees, and you ask them to pick up the phone and go and speak to a client and they're absolutely terrified. So I think reminding people that, you know, we can get an awful long way by just opening our mouths and speaking, asking, advocating for ourselves, discovering what it is that we need, and that would help us an awful lot beyond all the tech. And also, even when it comes to using the tech itself, it's, you know, having the confidence to get the training in it and not sort of write it off just because we're a certain age.
Robbie, how does this come up in your work? Because obviously you've got your personal experience, but you're also responsible for navigating how entertainment is changing.
I think, look, disabled people, blind people, yes, we are good with tech skills, but actually one of the skills that all blind people have is problem solving. There are basic skills that blind people have just because you're blind, just because you're disabled, that actually are really, really important in the workplace. You know, we spend our entire lives, if we can't find the road crossing, we're not just going to not cross the road, we're going to find a way to do it, we're going to problem solve. So it's about blind people, disabled people embracing the traditional skills as well as the new tech skills. And that really will, you know, help you as a disabled person, as a blind person, but it will help your employability prospects as well.
And it feels scary sometimes to try and learn new skills and set out on a journey on your own. But I think there's something about not being frightened to try things out as well. And We know that not everyone is getting the support they need. People are on long waiting lists in local authorities. People often don't have, you know, a ready-made social network to reach out to for some blind tips and tricks. So there's something about kind of just really, I suppose, trusting yourself and thinking, well, how could I perhaps try this without sight? And we've all tried things that have gone disastrously wrong. And there are very few of them that would land you in a serious enough situation that it's not worth giving it a go.
It's true, dude. People do wait around. Yeah. I remember when we used to go on trips, we'd be in a new hotel, a new city. Quite interesting seeing which guys would sort of wait in their room for the coach or the physio to come and sort of show them where everything was in the room, where everything was in the hotel. And me and my roomie, we were always, we said, right, let's go on a recce. And yeah, we would just start wandering off down the corridors, finding where the stairs were, finding, you know, where all these little nooks and crannies were. Where does this corridor lead to? And just having that kind of adventurous side to you. Before we had all this tech, well, we're on the bus, right? And you had to, so you're on a long straight road and you're thinking, you can ask the bus driver what stop you're going to get off, but you're relying on them remembering that. And you had to like develop your own ways of knowing whether it was counting the roundabouts or whatever it was. So I do think we are great problem solvers. And I think sometimes we can lose those skills through the tech. You know, tech can actually de-skill us in a way.
I think there is something in saying though that yes, you know, we do have to realise what our own skills are, but at the same time, employers, organisations, they can't just rely on us to solve all the problems. I think that is an important point to make. And you know, yes, disabled people can skill themselves, they can use traditional skills, but actually a lot of the time it isn't disabled people, it isn't blind people that need to make the change, it is non-disabled people, it is employers themselves.
All of you shared experiences where you wanted to work with someone to ask for some support or figure out a way of doing things, and they were resistant to working with you because they said they didn't have the right specific qualification or the right kind of training. What do you see as the solution for both balancing the training that other people need to have in place from their employers to be able to do things in a respectful way, but also kind of being met as real people who can communicate with each other and work through things together?
The one question, and it's kind of the start and end of it for me really, in any customer services environment, any environment where you're interacting with another person, is a simple question: how can I help? End. We don't need people to second guess. We don't need people to know intuitively what you're going to need, because we're all different. You know, Darren mentioned people not learning Braille, so totally blind doesn't equal Braille reader. No one knows what level of sight or vision people have and whether it's functional in light or dark, and how could they possibly? But the one question that we can all answer, and that it's all of our responsibilities to get confident and be able to answer, is the how can I help question.
I think for me, I'm not against training. I think training has its time and place. I think it's type training. First of all, if you're going to deliver, you know, whether it's disability quality training, disability impact training, you know, visual impairment training, if you haven't got the majority of your trainers either being disabled or being blind, then actually the training probably isn't that good. So I think it's about making sure the standard training you get, but make sure you're getting the right training rather than taking it from an impairment-specific approach. So simulating what it's like to be blind, take it from a barriers-led approach. Talk about the barriers people face in society. Talk about how to remove those barriers. Because actually, I could tell you that I've got bilateral microphthalmia and coloboma, but you're not going to know what that means. But if I tell you that I need support navigating a busy room or that I can't see a screen, you can help with that. So it's about using the training to get the right information out.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's kind of trying to tackle real world problems that we actually encounter, whether it is crossing roads which don't have crossings on them, whether it's, you know, getting around all sorts of places that we have to deal with. And I do sometimes think there's an industry around it in terms of creating qualifications, and they're doing it in all sorts of areas, whether it's the police or the NHS. You know, they're kind of putting qualifications in place for almost everything because we want to be able to distinguish between those who have that qualification and don't. But as we know, experience normally trumps qualifications in most situations. So I think, as Robbie said and Ellie have said, having people with lived experience are probably the best people to deliver that training.
Well, thank you so much for an excellent panel and for sharing your thoughts with us here on RNIB Connect Radio.